Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A delight to have you all with us on this 19th day of December. It is 12 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. We have a lot to talk about. We have a great group to do it. It is a windy, rainy, oddly warm day. And so it was like poo and the blustery day. That's sort of how it felt coming in, and a lot of stuff. It's just like this gauntlet of usually you just have to worry about deer dashing out in front of the road, but now it was like inflatable Santas and wreaths. To which Robert said,
tumble wreaths.
That's right. So see, and you thought we didn't rehearse the show. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started with the news of the day. A very busy news evening. I was telling the gang here, I was sucked into it. I watched it from like 6 o'clock until 1 in the morning, and well, we'll see if this paid off in ensuing discussion that we're about to have. The Ulster County Comptroller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, is here. Good morning, March. How are you?
Good morning. So glad to be here. Hoping that I am not contributing to the Albany economy with another school zone speeding ticket. I was really right on 20 today.
there you go. Very nice. Yeah, people now are just, you know, sending me all their stories, and I appreciate it. I know we're all in this together.
And I know exactly where those cameras are now on my route to WAMC, and I do 15 now because I've gotten one of those nastygrams as well.
Yeah. It's harder in the wind. that's right, our tailwind. Bill Hammond is with us, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good morning. Pleased to be here.
Very nice to have you, as always. Thank you.
I'm still, in spite of the weather, I'm still holding out hope of a white Christmas.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had it like last night in our place. It was white. And then this morning, it was all gone. But here we are. We welcome Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, our good friend Robert Pendicio. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. Thanks very much. And at the risk of injecting a somber note, can I just say a quick word about the passing of Norman Podoritz?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, one of the great privileges of my life is I'm an occasional contributor to Commentary Magazine, which he founded and which is now run by his son, John Podoritz. But, you know, whatever one thinks of Norman Podoritz's politics, he was one of the most influential public intellectuals of the last century or so. So he lived a rich, full life, you know, great intellectual, great American. So, you know, my condolences to John and his family. But what an intellectual giant he was, and what a great life.
Well, thank you. Yes, as you lose these people who are so important to us and to our thinking, it's always a sad day. All right, well, let's go to the news and see what's happening here. And again, I was captivated by the story. It was a pretty good murder mystery last night, real life unfolding. And there are still extremely odd things about it, but we'll do our best to discuss it. So, of course, for days, we have been talking about here the shooting at Brown University, where two people were killed, several others were injured, some gravely injured, and then the manhunt that continued and went on and seemed to go on for much longer than perhaps we were used to in such cases. Then at some point yesterday afternoon, there was a report that the death of a MIT professor, where a professor had been killed in his home 2 days after the Brown shooting, that those two were linked. Now, when it originally happened, when that professor was killed, there were people who asked the question, are these two things mm-hmm. connected? Authorities said we have no reason to believe they are connected. They seem to be very different cases, one very targeted, one not. So we don't believe that to be the case. Well, then evidence started to turn, and lo and behold, this becomes something that is that they are indeed connected. A man suspected of carrying out a pair of deadly attacks, one at Brown University that killed two students and wounded nine more, another that killed a Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor in his home, was found dead in a storage unit in New Hampshire on Thursday. The suspect's death, which the police said was from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, ended a five-day search that began on Brown's campus in Providence, Rhode Island. The case both captivated and rattled New England as investigators pieced together grainy surveillance footage and feared another burst of violence. The search stretched across state lines and ultimately hinged on witness interviews in Providence, including a Reddit user, along with records from a car rental agency in Boston and a search warrant in Salem, New Hampshire, which is where the storage facility was. Christina Paxson, the president of Brown University, said at a news conference, nothing can really bring full closure to the lives that have been shattered over the past week, but this may allow our community to move forward. Authorities said that they've identified the suspect as Claudio Manuel Neves Valente, 48 years old, a former Brown student who was briefly enrolled at the university more than two decades ago. He was last known to live in, last known address was in Miami. Investigators say they were not immediately certain of the motive behind the attacks, which killed two Brown students on Saturday, as well as the MIT professor on Tuesday. One breakthrough in the search for the gunman was when officers received information about a Reddit post in which a user claimed to have seen the suspect. The Reddit poster told the police that he followed the suspect before the shooting to a Nissan vehicle with Florida plates and at one point spoke to him. Mr. Valente briefly studied physics as a graduate student at Brown in the early 2000s, a Portuguese national. He became a permanent resident of the United States in 2017 through a diversity visa lottery. The authorities believe he also studied at the same school as the professor in Lisbon and said the two may have known each other, though details of their relationship remain unclear even at this hour. So those are some of the highlights as far as the story goes, that from the New York Times, and we can get into some more details as we work our way through the story this morning. Let us go to our group. We welcome you, by the way, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Robert.
What a strange story. I feel like I'm watching a jigsaw puzzle being put together in real time, where like certain patterns and pictures emerge. So where are we? Okay, we know a bit more, but far less than we'd like. To your very good point, Joe, these seem like such very, very different crimes. You know, a school shooting, which, you know, is alas prototypical, and then a very targeted assassination, if you like. So they've connected the suspect to the shooting at Brown, but also to that MIT professor. That's obviously an important development, but it raises more questions than it answers. What do these things have in common? I mean, look, I'm going to urge us to resist the speculation because it looks okay. Well, sure. What is Occam's razor? The most obvious explanation is the explanation. So he knew this guy back in Portugal. He attended Brown. All right, that makes sense. But I'm going to hedge my bets and say we're probably going to learn more about this as the days go on.
You don't think though that the key connector is going to be nuclear fusion scientists?
Well, no, you don't. But, you know, interestingly enough, in my frustration, I think a lot of us were frustrated following this story this week at how little we knew. And it also, am I alone in saying I got the sense that, one got the sense as a news consumer, oh, they know more than they're telling us. And that fuels speculation. Oh, one of the things I saw on social media, hey, he was a nuclear scientist. Maybe there's an Iranian angle because, you know, Israel killed all those nuclear scientists. The shooting in Brown. Oh, wait a minute, that the girl who was killed was the head of the Young Republicans. You know, that can't be a coincidence. Unfortunately, when you don't know things, it's just the way we live now. Speculation runs riot.
Absolutely. I'm interested in what you said, though, that were you the only person who thought that they knew more than they were letting on? I felt that they didn't.
They didn't. Yeah, okay.
I mean,
just
like,
they were telling us, like, what they didn't know.
Right. It seemed like I was hoping I was looking for the tell of, because yesterday you saw that play out. Like, they obviously knew a lot more than they were saying as the case wound down.
Okay.
They knew a lot. And they were careful. They didn't say they had a press conference scheduled for 4. It didn't happen until like 9.
Yeah.
So there was that. But in those early days, it just seemed, especially with all the misinformation that was being given,
yeah,
and all of the releases that were coming out that were taken back and so forth, and even the difficulty in finding the footage, mm-hmm, that they started to use.
Okay. But that's and I don't want to be unkind to the leadership of Brown University. But if I felt that their information is being withheld, I don't know that the president of Brown, Paxson, I believe is her name, conducted herself well. And look, there but for the grace of God go we all. Nobody wants to get thrown into the national spotlight for something like that. But there was this moment after the shooting, several hours, when a reporter asked her, well, what was happening in that room? And she said, I don't know. And the reporter pushed back saying, well, shouldn't you know? You're the president. Same thing with the... I guess there's an alert signal that was not activated.
No.
And she said, well, it's not for school shootings. And somebody said, well, yes, it is. Here's your own on your website. That is what it's for. So that led the sense that, why are they being this way? Are they either just obtuse or is there something else going on here?
Yeah. And then I guess both of our narratives then are filled in by that.
But that's why I'm thinking, you know, there's so the fog here is so thick. It would not surprise me if there's more that we don't know.
Part of what's interesting to me about this is how when we find out who the shooter is, we think we know last night, it defied so many expectations.
Right.
He was older than I would have expected.
Right.
He was from Portugal, not a country associated with, you know, a particular level of violence, mm-hmm, or terrorism or anything like that.
The Basques notwithstanding.
The connection between a mass shooting in a random style in a classroom against people that the shooter had no way of knowing versus a very targeted attack. He like just so many ways in which this does not, it's outside the norm,
yeah,
of violence generally. Like most violence is committed by young men, not 48-year-old men.
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you one thing that gives me a bit of comfort here. Maybe that's the wrong word. You know, anybody who was expecting or fearing, okay, there's going to be a political motivation here, it's almost ruefully comforting that it doesn't seem to be going in that direction. I mean, those of us who are of a certain age and remember just the tremendous political unrest and domestic violence that we lived through as young people in the 60s and 70s, you know, again, I don't know how to frame this correctly, but it's a comfort that it's not that.
Right, and I hope they don't make it into that, even if it
isn't
that.
Oh, we'll do that anyway.
Yeah, that's the problem. March.
I don't know if it's a comfort. I think we really need to move away from the place where violence is the way that you resolve your personal angst. And unfortunately, that's become, you know, a sort of standard fare. You're unhappy. You feel aggrieved. This is, you know, becoming an obvious, you know, way that people express themselves. And I think that it was immediately politicized by the Trump administration when they decided they're going to shut down, you know, diversity visas. 55,000, up to 55,000 people a year are able to come into the country under diversity visas from countries that are not well represented in most immigration proceedings. And, you know, now we're pointing the finger at that. I thought there was an interesting Uzbekistan connection, which was that
one of the victims
was from Uzbekistan, but also there was a diversity visa perpetrator who shot or killed 8 people in New York City and was convicted in 2023, and that person was from Uzbekistan. I think we have to not jump to conclusions about people's, you know, nationality, where they're coming from, right. what their motives are.
Right.
And I also, you know, as much as, you know, Brown and any organization facing this sort of like, you know, calamitous communication, right? We call it, you know, addressing really hard problems. But I think we need to give them some grace, too, because this is a really challenging sure. thing. And I blame the gun culture. I blame gun laws. I want to learn about where this fellow obtained his weapons and the know-how on how to change his plates, how to change his identity in terms of credit card transactions. There was a lot going on here. It's not just a failure at the school level.
You know, in a way, if I may, Joe, you're almost amplifying my point, March. Because, you know, I work in education. One of the things that concerns me, I don't have the data in front of me, but there have been polls that show alarming numbers of young people now believe that sometimes political violence is justified. So to reinforce Bill's point, the fact that it wasn't that it was a middle-aged man was a surprise and in my word, not yours, a bit of a comfort that it is not what we have been conditioned to expect.
I do agree with the grace that that March is suggesting, too. I think last night when you watched the press conference that was from Providence, that the Brown University Police Department, the Providence Police Department, the Attorney General, the mayor, the people who the federal agents that were involved worked really, really, really hard. I think under often difficult circumstances with a lot of finger pointing in different directions and probably some outside issues that they had to deal with. But it did seem as though as all the yelling and screaming was going on the outside, that this was a really good group of people that were dedicated to find this this individual. I mean, it's 5 days, and it seems like a long time, but given what you were saying, March, with the license plates and the credit cards and the deception and the oddness of the two events, that this was more complex than initially thought.
And before the show went live, we were talking about Kash Patel, you know, the head of the FBI, putting out news that they had somebody in custody, which they released later, and that's the second time he's done that. You know, hours, if not days, were lost in the investigation,
right.
possibly there.
Most of the day Sunday was lost.
Do we know why this gentleman, and we don't know who he is, thought that the responsible course of action here was to post this on Reddit as opposed to what sounds like, in retrospect, such a clear and obvious, hey, I need to go to the police with this.
There was a Reddit thread apparently that was started by some of the agencies. He was responding and said, you really have to look at this car.
Yeah.
And then he has said that it was due to his own concerns for safety and privacy. To his credit, when the police put out the call that said, we need to talk to you, mm-hmm. within minutes, he was talking to police.
So the Reddit thread, he was communicating to
law enforcement.
Law enforcement, yeah. And sort of the general community.
It was a law
community.
Enforcement thread?
Yeah,
not
it
a
was
Reddit
sort of overall thread, okay. of the case.
Wow, that's opening a whole new wrinkle in law enforcement. Like when you're investigating, yeah. you open a Reddit thread.
Yeah.
You know, I think you'll take whatever you can get at that point, right? We'll take a break. We'll be back. We'll consider. We'll consider a lot of stuff. But all things considered, it's later. We'll consider things right after this short break. Good morning. Thank you so much for being with us. We love having you on, listening to the program and being with us each day. And we thank you very much for being here and taking moments out of your day, whether you're listening to us right now at 9:34 a.m. or if you're listening to us later. Via podcast, whatever the case may be. We are glad that you are tuning in, and we thank you very much for being a part of our program. We are talking about the arrests, we believe a conclusion to the killings and the shooting at Brown University, where two students were shot and killed during a study session on Saturday. And then later, 2 days later, the killing of a professor at MIT outside of Boston. Those cases connected, apparently, according to authorities. And the person they believe responsible for both acts of violence, was found dead in a storage unit at in Salem, New Hampshire, last night. How long he had been there is still a question, and at what point, what that timeline is after Tuesday seems to be something that authorities continue to work on. We have a letter from Vincent who says one of your panelists suggested that Brown MIT incidents were outside the norms of violence. God help us if there is a norm of violence. Violent individuals are never normal. They are seriously disturbed with all too easy access to guns. I do think it is safe to say that we, unfortunately and sadly and tragically, there in school shootings have become, there is a pattern, and yes, that has been sort of a normal pattern that is tragic and awful, and yet still a pattern.
Yeah, if that was me, if I said norms of violence, then I take the correction. I misspoke. I didn't mean that violence is normalized. I mean there's a school shooters are not do not do crimes of passion. People who do crimes of passion don't do school. You know, we've been conditioned to expect patterns of violence, not normal or normalized violence.
I want to push back on that a little bit. I think we have seen a couple of school shooters actually leave the school shooting setting, go home, and then take, you know, violent measures against family members.
Yes.
So, you know, it makes you wonder about the relationship between these two people and that they may have been closer than it first appears.
This is why I said at the outset, I'm waiting for more facts here because, you know, there seems to be, you know, a through line here, but this story has had no shortage of surprises so far.
No, that's absolutely true. And I also think that when you look at all of the questions that were answered last night, and yes, maybe tentatively, there are so many more questions to be answered in this, and so many more. And like any time when the perpetrator ends up dead, you lose that as far as the information. So in both these cases, two students and a professor, not to mention the shooter, have all perished. Mm-hmm. So that less information coming from that. We have this, that a few pieces of information have been put together. The Reddit poster was a custodian in the building where the shooting happened. He had observed the killer walking around the building before. He had actually followed him and challenged him as to what his business was on campus. That is from Paul. I'm not doubting you, Paul. I don't have.
I hadn't heard that he was a custodian.
Proof on that. So,
if he really was a custodian in the building, a Brown employee, that, and again, I don't want to be critical of people in extreme circumstances, but that kind of raises the further is my question, like, why didn't you go to the police immediately with this?
Don't know. And again, I'm only reading. Yeah. I don't know what the case is.
My heart breaks for the students that have lived now through multiple school shootings. And there was
two of them.
There were a couple students there, one from Parkland and one from another school shooting.
Saugus.
That's terrible. That's we should not be in this place.
You know, and that's when you say, when you use the word normal. I mean, you know, no, not nor none of us is normal. But, you know, if you're a kid and you're going to high school and college and there's two shootings in your life.
Goodness.
Good Lord. Those are, you would think those are, like, the odds are just astronomical.
I think there's got to be an element of social contagion that when you these events, for understandable reasons, become big news, and so you can't really avoid hearing about these, you know, school shootings and other mass shootings, and the idea gets planted in your head. This is something people do.
Mm-hmm.
It's something people do as a way of expressing their anger or their political beliefs or whatever, and so when you're having a mental crisis or an emotional crisis, it's on the list of things in your head that's available for this is how it's not rational, right? But I don't think there's any way to avoid the idea that it's that like when we like once it's contagious. Like yeah. The idea spreads that way, and unfortunately, just talking about it contributes to that.
It's a really good point, Bill. Yeah. And by coincidence, on Monday night, I'm a volunteer firefighter down in Medusa where I live. And we had a training on mass casualty shootings, and that the point you just raised was exactly the thrust of the training. That, you know, the way to prevent these is by recognizing the warning signs when people are tipping into this, and then injecting yourself into it. It's not to wait. Even as first responders, even though if God forbid this should ever happen in our community, you know, myself and others would be first responders. You want to avoid that. You want to recognize the signals and get involved before it happens.
Kathleen asks, is it really over? Did the guy in the storage unit really commit suicide? It's another abnormal part of this abnormal event. And I mean, that's the other thing. A lot of this is going to be questioned and you were referring to this earlier. I mean, it's just you're going to look at it. It's going to be speculation. There's going to be questions, and a lot of people are going to try to fill in the blanks however they can.
Well, but I was going to say, in the absence of information,
that's not against
people. No, of course, people will create their own narratives. The other downside is, and we've seen it in this instance as well. Even when you know the facts, you use it to support your pre-existing narratives.
That's another really kind of vicious thing that happens in these situations is people with agendas on social media in particular will assert without information.
With great confidence.
Yeah. They'll assert this must be Islamist terrorist or this must be anti-Semitic or they'll seize on perceived evidence and they'll spread it.
Yep.
And there will be, as a result of that, there will be a large number of people who will believe it.
Well, it gets worse.
And then when the facts come out, they're unwilling to believe the facts.
There you go. That's exactly right. Because I've already married myself to this
narrative.
It's a kind
of psychosis going on here.
Well said.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to another letter. This one from, and we welcome your letters, by the way, panel@wamc.org. All this discussion about motive is really misplaced. The focus should be on gun reform 24/7. Once again, the media just focuses on the wrong thing, and we're like the rat on the wheel, blaming the media. These are really sad, tragic times, and there's no light for any of us. Maureen, I certainly understand the frustration. I do think that I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I do think that I know on this program, and I know in many, many other programs that I've been watching over the last week, the gun question has certainly been very much a part of the discussion. And to the points that many of our panelists have already made, I believe Robert was the one who brought it up first, though, that we're going to find out more, and March said this as well. Once we know about the weapons that were used in this particular case, we know that there were two weapons apparently found with him when he was found in the storage unit. There was also a satchel. What else was in the car? Where there was also a hotel apparently. So to find all that information, I think it may just be a little premature to go to exactly what we know about how these guns were purchased, how these guns were used. I mean, obviously we know they were used to kill people, but let us I think there's time. But again, as far as the media goes, I do believe there has been a lot of attention as far as gun laws and gun ownership in this country as a result of this and the countless other shootings that
have taken
place. There
was a different tenor, I thought, to the national reaction to the shooting in Australia than there was to this Brown shooting in the United States. And it was shock and horror. And it was, I think, just treated in a more elevated way. And I don't mean to be dismissive, but I felt the Brown shooting was a little bit of a shrug and like, oh, here we go again here in the United States. That's not how it was handled in Australia. And you know, I just on the way in was listening to the prime minister there talking about a gun buyback program that'll be the biggest one ever. I just, you know, we don't have that national leadership and messaging around gun safety and gun violence right now. And, you know, the reaction just culturally was different.
Australia has some of the most restrictive gun laws
yeah.
on the planet, however.
Yep.
So I don't want to be that guy, but they weren't effective.
In that case.
Right.
Right. But it's still much less than other places in the world.
That's fine.
Way fewer.
Yeah.
But I found it a little ironic, and I don't mean to be arch here, but what happened in Australia was an act of terrorism. The idea that you would deter terrorism with a gun buyback strikes me as fanciful.
Well, I'm not sure that's their only approach. I just think it's one approach. But I was more talking about the way people express their horror seemed different.
Sure. Let's take a break. Before we do, I'll lead us into a break with this letter. I can't take it anymore. All week, the panel has been talking about the shooting at Brown as if it's a police TV show. Stop it. You know better, all of you. For example, the janitor didn't inform the police. Really? You actually believe that? Or it's more likely that the janitor did talk to the police and both he and the police sat tight on this information so as not to tip off the murderer? Stop acting like the bloodthirsty vultures you are, constantly jumping to conclusions that people accuse all of you in the media of being. Again, stop it. All of you at WAMC know better. You should be pointing out where the rest of the media is getting it wrong. And that's from John. We'll be back right after this.
Was it all caps?
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So we're going to move on to other issues this morning. We still welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so You know, this is another one of those things where this is a story that I don't particularly want to talk about, but I do think it's important to talk about because everyone's talking about it. And I feel that when we don't talk about things that everyone's talking about, we're doing a disservice. Mm. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but the Trump Kennedy Center.
Oh, no. Oh,
now, no. I last...
You mean the Kennedy Center.
Well, it is the Kennedy Center, but now if you go to the website, it is the Trump Kennedy Center. They have a logo and everything.
Is it gold?
Much like the Department of War. Gold leaf, right.
Gulf of America.
Yeah. So, okay.
Oh, no.
So, here we go. As I said, this is one of those stories that does capture people's attention, and I think it tells us a lot about the players involved. But the board for the JFK Center for the Performing Arts Center announced that it would now be named the Trump Kennedy Center, although a formal change may have to be approved by Congress. For the life of me, I don't understand why they don't know that for sure.
It doesn't come up. When you pass a law, it doesn't occur to you that we need to
read it?
Restrict the president from renaming things. Actually, in this case, it was the board.
Yeah, but he's the chairman of the board.
But I have to sympathize with the people who wrote whatever law it is that created the Kennedy Center. That it just didn't occur to them that this would ever be an issue.
No, but I was under the impression, and it is the people who say that it does have to go through Congress say that, look, if you change, when we changed it to from National Airport to Reagan National Airport, there had to be an act of Congress that made that happen. So President Trump's takeover of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts reached its inevitable conclusion on Thursday afternoon when it was announced that the center's board of trustees has voted to rename it the Trump Kennedy Center. By the way, this did not go over well within the Kennedy family, RFK perhaps withstanding. Even though Mr. Trump had already been calling it that for months in trollish posts online, he acted shocked that his handpicked board had thought to do this for him. I was honored by it, actually, he told reporters in the White House. The board is a very distinguished board, most distinguished people in the country. They're very distinguished. And I was surprised by that because I was honored by it because they are so distinguished, he said. Earlier that day, he had called into a meeting of the board, which is now made up entirely of people who are loyal to him. By law, there are a handful of members of Congress from both parties who sit on the board as well, although several of those members say that they were not informed of the meeting until the last moment. They joined by Zoom and were then muted and not allowed to actually vote within the confines, which made them even madder when they said that it was
unanimous.
Yes. Okay. Unusually, the meeting was taking place not at the Kennedy Center, but at the Palm Beach home of the casino magnate Steve Wynn, whose wife Andrea sits on the board.
Apparently, it's not her home as well.
Correct. Richard Grenell, the center's Trump-appointed president, was there, and so was Lee Greenwood, who performed God Bless the USA at the meeting, which I think whenever he shows up, he performs God Bless the USA, doesn't he? That's what he does.
It's like so many stories, this could have been written by Mad Libs.
I know. You're right. You're absolutely
Insert name of country singer here. You know?
Yeah. Yep. Oh, and I bet if I read the entire story, I'm going to say the words Kid Rock. I know that. Another member who was in Beach for the meeting was Sergio Gore, a longtime aide to the president who was recently nominated to be the ambassador to India. It was Mr. Gore who proposed the name change. But there was at least one person who was not down with the idea. This is Representative Joyce Beattie, a Democrat of Ohio, who had called into the meeting. It was such a surprise to me when they said, we're going to rename it, she recounted in a phone interview. I said, oh my gosh, and pushed my button. But then I was muted and everyone who was not there was cut off. And they immediately said, well, it's unanimous. Everybody is for it. Ms. Wynn claimed in a phone interview that she was not aware that Ms. Beattie had been muted and that she did not know who was responsible for that. As for how the president reacted to the name change, I think he was very happy. Ms. Beattie described the meeting this way. Everything was regurgitated about how awful anything with the center was, how run down it was, how everything was humiliating, and now they had come in as the great saviors of it. She added that the other members took turns praising Mr. Trump, who then pretended to be surprised when they voted to rename the joint after him, her words. He said, oh, I didn't know you were all going to name it after me, even though he had been calling that himself for the past 3 months. March.
So if you have to ask for it, it's not an honor. I just want to say that to everybody who's listening. Like, when you have to ask for the honor, it's not an honor. But I was struck how, you know, it was named after Kennedy as a memorial. You cannot.
For a fallen president.
Yes, who was shot. I mean, who's killed. You're not memorializing a living president. I was also really struck by the tone of the article. I mean, you know, it really it was very gendered. Everybody else here sitting at this table is a man, but I read the article and I was very insulted that they said that it was Steve Wynn's house. They made it sound like his wife doesn't live there. They talked about how everybody's wives are on the board, and then we also just heard that Usha Vance is on the board. But the wives of Robert Kraft and Ike Perlmutter. These women have their own identities. And then the thought to me about them getting together at this private location just seems like a very backroom deal. And the husbands were there partying. So it's a very, non-professional approach.
Is the article gendered or the event gendered? I mean, the meeting gendered.
The way the article expressed the fact that it was the wives of these important men dismissed the wives as having their own legitimate backgrounds.
I agree with you, but that also seems like that was done
maybe intentionally
by the organization.
And let me lastly say the last thing I want to note is that, there's a lot we don't know. The Joyce Beattie was saying that she tried to vote and then they pushed back and said, well, she's not a voting member. And why don't we know that? Get the bylaws and let's figure it out. It's
yeah,
not
and,
that hard.
And she has shown proof that she indeed was a voting member. So that's one thing. There were other people who had questions about the rebrand, and many of course, the staff members and both current and former were asking questions if the name change was legal. The Performing Arts Center is by design designated by the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. It was built to be a living memorial to the slain 35th president, and it has been generally understood that the power to change the name lies with Congress.
Oh, you had to bring this one up, didn't
yeah.
you, Joe, huh?
Yeah. As I said, I'm not happy about it.
Yeah, okay. I have never suffered from what is popularly known as Trump derangement syndrome. I try to take it as it comes. When the moment calls for it, I will support this president, on Israel, on confronting Iran's nuclear ambitions, on some of his foreign policy realism. When he overreaches, like blurring the line between drug traffickers and terrorists, using the military as a police force, I am critical of that. So I don't suffer from TDS, but I am starting to suffer from Trump fatigue.
the lesser version.
Well, if you like, the nonstop drama, the trolling, the narcissism. Rod Dreher, who's a conservative commentator, I think he works for First Things. He said on Twitter, which by the way, apropos of name changes, I will not call it X. Twitter. Yeah.
It's Trump Twitter.
There you go. He put a profane post up this morning, I think, maybe it was yesterday, asking whether Trump wakes up each morning thinking about how to make people hate him. I wouldn't put it that way, but I think he's on to something.
I've been struck, since 2015, that Trump has a superpower, and his superpower,
and we're doing it right now,
pushing
people.
It's
absolutely
pushing people's buttons.
Yeah,
and he pushes people's buttons in a way that erases what you it overrides what you were mad about 24 hours
and now
ago.
Now I'm mad about
so
this.
Remember the whole Rob Reiner thing? He generated a news cycle yeah. by saying insulting things about Rob Reiner on the occasion of his murder. And then before that, we were talking about how he was blowing up boats in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And before that, there was something else which I can't remember now because it's been erased by the blowing up.
Yeah.
But it's this mix of the serious and the non-serious.
Yes. Right? And the blowing up boats thing and the possibility of a war in Venezuela, the blockade that we've set up off the shore of Venezuela, which is an act of war. That's so much more important. But his superpower is yeah. to do something so outrageous, so obnoxious.
Charlie Brown and the football, the Trump football.
He's
renamed it.
You cannot stop paying attention.
Well, no, but also, I mean, right? I agree that by the way, I completely agree with Robert about the fatigue, but. They doze the White House. It is a real thing. It actually happened. You saw them just
He's
ripping
the leader
it
of
apart.
The free world. You cannot stop. You cannot not pay attention to stuff he does because he's the president.
It's the East Wing or the Rose Garden or the Colonnade or whatever the case may be. Now they have the plaques up under the presidents
Former
and
presidents,
he's read that there's new signage there. Yeah. It just goes on and on. The one we have to go to a break, but the one line here in this article that I liked, I thought was important. It said people employed at the Kennedy Center said yes, they were saddened by the news, but they realized that it stopped becoming the Kennedy Center when Trump took it over. Basically, it already became the Trump Center in everything but name anyhow. And I think that it doesn't excuse it, but it does make a very, very solid point. We'll take a break. We'll be back right after this. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 19th of December. It is 7.5 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to move on here in just a second, but I know, Robert, you wanted to make a point.
No, I just wanted to add on to what Bill was saying. The real cost of this kind of faux debate, if you like, is it's not hurt feelings at the Kennedy Center. It's that the constant drama crowds out the seriousness. And I don't know how to do this because, Joe, you're absolutely right that if people are talking about it, so should we. But how do we, and it's an open question in my mind, how do we as commentators draw the line between what is worth people's time, what is a serious debate, and what is just venting our spleen?
I mean, it's a good point, but I do think, you know, there is an outrage that comes from some,
yep,
regarding it, and which, I mean, quite frankly, I get, and in this case, I find myself agreeing with that outrage, but I, which has, I think, probably even more to do with nostalgia, but also what is right for the Kennedy family, and that was a living memorial, and to change that seems to be disrespectful. But
I think it's a mistake to pass over the cultural outrages if they're not, you know, geopolitical movement for national security. It's still important, and we're becoming, you know, used to it. It's becoming normal milieu that these things are happening, and I think we should continue to call them out because they are outrageous. If it was Obama, people would have been beside themselves. So I think we need to continue to call it out, even if it seems minor in substance.
It's a very good point. All right. Let's move on this Friday. We go to another story, and I thought we would talk about, we didn't talk about this yesterday, and I do believe it's worth talking about as it comes to the control of Congress. And that is Mike Johnson, who in this very weird walk and talk from the chamber to his office outside of the rotunda, Johnson, in a voice that almost sounded as if he was 13 years old and his voice was changing as he was saying these lines, but he said, "Yes, I'm still in control." So the article being, Johnson says he still controls the House, some fellow Republicans disagree. This is from the Washington Post. Following a year of guiding an unruly House Republican conference to legislative victories, there are signs that Speaker Mike Johnson is losing his grip. For the fourth time in recent weeks, a group of frustrated Republicans banded with Democrats to try to force a vote on legislation that Johnson fought to keep from reaching the House for. Tensions boiled over Wednesday when four moderate Republicans, scorned by Johnson's decision to withhold votes on their health care proposals, joined all Democrats in muscling the House to vote next month on a bill led by Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries that would extend enhanced Affordable Care Act tax credits for 3 years. With the House adjourning for the year on Thursday, Johnson is downplaying tensions among Republicans that for months he had tamped down with the help of President Donald Trump. On Wednesday, he insisted that he has not lost control of the House. But some of his colleagues are beginning to question that. House Republicans' narrow majority has tested Johnson's hold on the Speaker's gavel since he unexpectedly ascended to the job in October of 2023. Johnson often finds himself in the middle of warring GOP factions, taking his time to decide what a majority of his colleagues would support and hoping that an opposing flank does not spark a rebellion.
I would not want to be him. He's in such a challenging position. I mean, he continues to have Trump's support, which is amazing. But, you know, I read one Republican member who basically said, you know, the fact that they blocked the moderate Republican amendments led to the Democratic bill now reaching the floor. It's legislative and political malpractice. And I have to think most of the conference probably does feel that way. You know, they don't want to see Democratic bills reaching the floor and being supported by the American people. So this really is sort of elevating Jeffries' bill and I think making a lot of people unhappy. I also thought it was funny to see people saying that, you know, Massey wouldn't vote for puppies, you know, that he's been so cantankerous. He's not one of the four Republicans that voted for this, you know, so... Yeah, Johnson is in a really, really difficult position, but I don't think they're going to find the 9 votes to get him out. They would need 9 Republicans to make a change, and I just don't think they're going to do it. They don't want to relive the Kevin McCarthy era when you couldn't get anything done, and they had those weeks and weeks of leadershipless House. I think having a leader like Johnson in charge of the House doing nothing is more palatable to them than having a leaderless rudder. So I think we're going to see it continue the way it is for a while.
I think we in the media and maybe the American public as well have sort of schizophrenic ideas of how Congress should work. On the one hand, we want it to be bipartisan, and we want people to work across the aisle. And on the other hand, we expect the partisan speaker to have an iron control. Like, we resent it when he exercises his iron control, and then when he doesn't have iron control, we make fun of him. Like, that's yeah. sort of what's going on here. And, of course, it is super narrow majority that effectively gives a handful of members the ability to hold the whole institution hostage, right? Like, if I don't know what the exact number is, but apparently it's four. Right? If four Republicans mm-hmm. are willing to break ranks with the Speaker and give their support to something the Democrats want, that's enough to shift the whole mm-hmm. debate because it's so narrowly divided. You're not going to get a strong Speaker in that environment. You know, and in addition, he was elected under these rules in which it's easier to remove him than it had been mm-hmm. traditionally. So he's got to be aware of that. That's exactly what happened to his predecessor. So I don't – like, it's a tricky job. I don't know. I'm not close enough to it to know whether he's doing it well, handling it well. But I'm not surprised that he's running into troubles like this because it's just inherent to the situation.
It's almost as if we're on the eve of midterm elections or something.
I know,
And members have to consider their own, you know, prospects back home. Oh, we are on the eve of the midterms. Gee, that must be part of it, right? Look, the story here, to my mind, I'll defer to my fellow panelists who are more close political observers than I am, but it's a math problem, right? It's just arithmetic. It's a narrow House majority. There are deep internal divisions, frankly, within both parties, and a midterm electorate that historically punishes the party in power. So it should surprise no one that certain members of the House are going to be, you know, looking to their own narrow self-interest going into 2026. But, you know, don't discount the fact that the Democrats face some of the same issues as well. You know, they face pressure from their left that can complicate efforts to present themselves as a, you know, sober centrist policy going into 2026. So I guess I'm surprised that we're surprised by any of this.
So go ahead.
I was, you know, when Biden won and had majority in both houses at the beginning of his term, I was incredibly frustrated as a Democrat and somebody who's obviously very active in Democratic politics with the slowness of getting anything done. I just wanted to beat my head against the wall. Like, can't you get this infrastructure thing done, right? And I'm still frustrated at how, you know, it did get passed. I'm frustrated at how slowly it went. The money did not get out on the street before the next presidential election, which is a huge mistake. But when I look back at the major pieces of legislation that passed during the Biden administration, right, the American Rescue Plan, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, like, we actually got stuff done. As mad as I was, as slow as it was, as horrible as it was to get it done, this Congress is doing nothing. Except for the big, beautiful bill. That's it. That's all we've had.
So since I'm a health policy guy, I should talk a little bit about the substance of this fight that we're talking about had to do with these enhanced tax credits for mm-hmm. people buying health insurance. Something like one, I don't have the percentages in my head, but there's a certain percentage of Americans who buy their health insurance through the Obamacare exchanges. These original ACA tax credits made it more affordable, and the enhanced tax credits added to that. They're due to expire at the end of this month, just a few days away. And there's a dispute within the Republicans about whether they should extend those tax credits. Mm-hmm. There's some Republicans, they're called moderates, who are worried that if they allow them to expire and don't do anything to restore them, they're going to pay a price for that at the polls, so the midterm election coming up. And they had like a Republican version of extending the tax credits. They wouldn't be as generous as they had been, and they would have anti-fraud measures and stuff like that. But Mike Johnson didn't want to take a vote on that policy. I guess the majority of his conference probably did not support that policy, and he didn't want to have them forced to take an up or down vote on that issue.
And there was a shutdown over this, for pity's sake.
You don't want your members to vote against extending the tax credits, but they don't want to vote for right, them either. Right. That's the kind of dilemma Mike Johnson faces on a lot of issues, where they don't want it to happen, but they don't want to vote against it. And then there were four members, one of whom is from New York, Mike Lawler, who signed the discharge petition. So that sort of forces a vote that they don't want to take. That's the political embarrassment. But it only took four Republicans to make that happen. It's all about health care, folks. it's all about how much we should be spending on our health insurance and how we should be financing.
Can you remind me the ACA? What does the first A in that stand for again?
Affordable.
Oh, okay, that's right. Whatever happened to that?
Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was the original name.
Okay, so it's not the SCA, it's not the Subsidized Care Act, it's the Affordable Care Act.
That gets to a debate about what affordability means. Does it mean making the thing less expensive inherently, or does it mean
for someone?
When can I make my joke that the president hadn't heard of that word before?
Affordability?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people are talking about affordability.
Yes.
I think if we got the profit out of healthcare, it would go a long way to making it affordable.
Yeah, it sounds great until you decide that, gee, I don't want to be in this business anymore if I can't make a profit.
There is profit in healthcare, but a lot of that profit is flowing to the doctors and the people that we want to make money in healthcare.
So, Bill Hammond, not to put you on the spot, but where are we when it comes to healthcare now? I mean, nothing is moving forward, obviously, in this Congress. They're headed home. So we look to calendar year 2026. Where are we? Is there still seems to be talk that, okay, something needs to be done. We'll figure out what that is when we get back.
We are in 2021 or the early 2021. So by letting these enhanced tax credits expire, we're rolling back the clock on to the policy that existed before the enhanced tax credits were passed. They were passed as a pandemic response
COVID,
measure,
right.
they were made temporary. That's why they're expiring. So if the status quo in 2020, 2021 wasn't perfect, but it wasn't a catastrophe either, and we're going back to that. Now, for individual families, there are certain people who are in a situation where they're unsubsidized, or they're losing all subsidies, or their subsidy is getting smaller, and that will lead to an increase in their costs. Some of them may, in fact, decide it's too expensive and drop their insurance. Those are not, I don't know how to phrase this. Those are uncommon situations. Most people either get their insurance through their employer, or they're eligible for Medicaid or Medicare. In New York State, the number of people affected by this is 0.6%. It's 140,000 people. I don't want to dismiss that. That's more than the population of Albany. But it's an exceptional situation. And they're not like having their health care ripped away. They're just having their subsidies are being reduced. And it will be painful for them, no doubt. And in some cases, they will just not be able to afford their health insurance.
We're going to see healthy people leave the pool.
Yeah. Yeah. Having complained about the politicization of everything, now I'm going to have to do it, Bill, and just ask you, I'm curious your answer, what's the right move for the Republicans here? Because it feels to me as if they're between a rock and a hard place. In other words, the fact that these have to be subsidized proves the point that the ACA has not had its intended effect, but they don't want to be the Grinch and oppose those subsidies because that will cost them in the midterms.
I'm a believer in incrementalism when it comes to healthcare. So you want to move. You have to not overly disturb the existing system, but move it in a better direction. I think the idea that was on the table that actually some Republicans have put forward, which was to extend the subsidies, but to reform them. There has been an issue with fraud as a result of these enhanced subsidies because it creates a situation where some people don't have to pay a premium, and you had brokers enrolling people without their permission, collecting a commission on their insurance, and they weren't paying a premium, so they didn't realize they were enrolled. That's the nature of the fraud. So one of the proposals was just to eliminate the zero premium plans. seems like a reasonable approach to fixing fraud. But yeah, so I would have, that would be my instinct, is to gradually modify the things you think are going wrong.
But am I wrong to think that if we extend the subsidies, that we will have yet another shutdown or threatened shutdown? You know, next time this comes up, in other words, unless you ratchet them down or do something like you're proposing, you're just kicking the can down the road, right?
Well, you don't have to make them temporary. You don't have to have an expiration date. You can leave it up to the future lawmakers to decide whether they want to continue them or not, but you don't have to create a deadline by putting an expiration
and work on an alternative plan. Look at all this energy that went into Project 2025. That should have been spent, that energy and time should have been spent on how do we reform healthcare in the United States. That would have been a good use of energy.
But I should express at least a little bit of sympathy with the point of view that because healthcare is like a fifth of our economy. It's close mm-hmm. to that.
Right.
And it's growing.
Yeah.
And there's some good reasons why it's growing, but then there are also not so good reasons. And it part of the problem is that we haven't figured out a way as a society to say no when somebody wants a service, we don't want to say no to that. And then when the provider wants to get paid, they can set whatever they can almost virtually set their own price. Yeah. I mean, the providers are probably gritting their teeth when they hear this because they're constantly fighting with insurers and Medicaid and Medicare. But if you just look at the bottom line, the amount of money we pour into healthcare just keeps going in one direction, and
it's not sustainable.
But your expertise, not mine. That's because there's nothing. There's no downward force on prices.
There's no
right?
effective downward force.
This is what we see. I've talked about this before in the roundtable with student loans. In other words, if you forgive them, there's no reason for colleges to lower their price. Same dynamic here, right?
Very similar. Okay. Yeah. And it's partly a result of the subsidies. The subsidies are kind of deflecting the pain, so that we're borrowing all the money.
Is there a way to transfer some of the cost of the subsidies onto the providers?
Because
would be my answer for student loans is, sure, do student loan forgiveness, but it's got to come out of the hide of colleges and universities, not the taxpayer. Making public policy here on the fly on the round table.
So the arch conservative point of view on this is that we should get away from insuring everything and have people pay directly for care. But care, that'd be very difficult to get to because of how expensive care has gotten under the subsidized system.
Yeah.
Sort of like asking people to suddenly pay their entire tuition bill without any financial aid.
Did exactly that.
Yeah, some people still do, but it's getting rare.
We're making it rare,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because the majority of people wouldn't be able to go to college if that was the approach that we took. So
yeah, just we're making it rare. Who's making who? Who is the they? Who is the we in that? We are making it rare.
No, in other words, if we continue to subsidize, look, I'm almost making a devil's advocate argument here, because I don't have firm opinions about this. But subsidies are not free, right? So what you're doing with the subsidy is you're not lowering the cost, you're transferring the cost.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is that we're transferring it to future generations,
right?
Because we're borrowing so much money. So and you see a phenomenon where the state lawmakers, they think the federal government should pay for everything because they understand that it's not it's not real money. It's monopoly money. It's paper money. And even you hear it from members of Congress saying, well, why shouldn't we spend more? We're just borrowing it. The mentality is
I mean, let's compare the cost of the subsidies to, the cost of the tax breaks for, extremely wealthy people in the One Big Beautiful Bill, right? To me, it's one is outsized. And that's the tax break. So I push back on that and say, to me, the subsidies benefiting, I think it's 24 million Americans who are getting the subsidies, 24 million Americans versus a very small group. So it's to me, it's about the distribution of wealth and how we address that.
All right. Anybody else? We have 1 minute before we go to break.
Don't you have an angry letter to read?
Oh, I always have angry letters to read. We'll go to those.
Turn down your volume, folks.
Yes, I could do some of my best acting during that. Maybe we should all have detailed discussion on healthcare options. A country as rich as ours should be able to figure this out. Healthcare for all, says Will. Then, Diane. With everyone going home for the recess, they will be hearing an earful from their district. Any wonder why there are those who are scrambling to show something that they have tried, quote unquote, to do in this case?
Mike Lawler will have something to talk about in that vein.
What Bill was saying about, you know, the states thinking the federal government, New York thinking the federal government should pay for everything, to me that rings true too. Counties, we think the state should pay for everything.
One more letter, this one from Craig. Doesn't it seem disingenuous to make fun of the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act when conservatives don't even have an outline of a plan other than taking away insurance from people with pre-existing conditions? If you have something better, then do it, for God's sake. That from Craig. We'll pause there. We'll come back right after this short break. Welcome back to the roundtable. I'm sorry for the extension there. I'm reading a letter that I'll have to read off the air, but I'm fascinated by it because I've just seen the words, excuse this cheeky email, and now I want to read it, so I apologize. Linda writes to us and says, having worked for 37 years for a not-for-profit healthcare provider, some of what the panel just said literally scares me to death. The cuts that are coming with the affordable plan coming to an end will possibly bring an end to some of these hospitals. True or false, Bill Hammond?
I think there's a lot of apocalyptic thinking about these cuts. I mean, like I say, we're going back to the status quo that was 4 or 5 years ago, that the various institutions of healthcare were not dying then, and I just don't think it's going to be the catastrophe that some people are portraying.
He's right.
I hope you're right. Yes, I think generally most people hope you are right.
We all hope there's no catastrophe.
Melissa writes, it is so nice to be able to have the ability to afford decent education. The system is damaged due to the fact that people who are hoarding money at the tippity top of this disgusting trickle-down theory are doing just that. A government that respects the right to life and the pursuit of happiness for all their people does not subsidize the wealthy. That from Melissa. Now we go to Matthew. Your panelists are taking the view of the upper middle class and the owners of our society. Everyone can afford what they need if only they would use their willpower and pay their fair share. This is nonsense. We need to borrow from the future to create subsidies. We can tax the rich to pay for subsidies. If we want everyone to afford health care, we can also make health care cheaper. And there are ways, whether the health care is government provided or provided by the market, it is always regulated. And there are ways to regulate it so that there is downward pressure. It's done in other countries. Every other civilized country has some form of socialized healthcare and spends less than they are putting up false choices and then saying, oh, well, we have to make a more market choice and people will somehow afford it. This is just the argument of the ruling class. I, just for the record, added the periods in that because otherwise there were none. Go ahead.
I think people have a misconception about how our healthcare system works. It is heavily socialized. Mm-hmm. In New York State, something like 40% of the population is on either Medicaid or the Essential Plan, which are fully socialized health plans. And then there's a whole other chunk who are on Medicare, which is a largely socialized health plan. It's the number one expense that the federal government spends money on, borrowed or otherwise, is healthcare, Medicaid and Medicare. A lot of that money to the extent it's not borrowed, a lot of that money is coming from wealthy people paying taxes. We have a you know, we have a progressive tax system. Maybe it's not as progressive as some people would like, but we do tax wealthy people more than we tax low income people. And also our healthcare system is not as dramatically different from other countries as we often think. The original idea of Obamacare, which was going to be a mix of public and private plans, had an individual mandate in it. That was going to get us very close to the system in Switzerland, I think it is. But the individual mandate was extremely unpopular. And it didn't even, like, it was a mandate in theory. It didn't have a strong enough penalty. That is kind of the psychological hump I think we have to get over as a country, is the idea, do we want to require people to have health insurance? Mm-hmm. And if we're not willing to require them, are we willing to let them kind of flounder when they don't have health insurance? But until we get over that psychological hump, we're never going to quite get to the idea of universality that exists in other countries. We have a version of universality in the U.S., which is a elaborate safety nets. I think a lot of what that letter writer says is how we do things right now, and it's not that different.
I can't believe the letter writer saying that about the whole panel, since I'm sitting here saying deprofit healthcare, tax the billionaires. I guess, you know, maybe they didn't hear what I had to say on that. But no,
they do tend to lump us all together.
Yeah, we're all one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was arguing for lower prices, so I also feel unheard. But hey, I'm sitting in front of a microphone, and they're not, so I have that. Look, you know, I don't know much about healthcare at all, but I know education. So when I hear, like, the key to lower cost is socialization, the key to lower higher quality is socialization. Well, forgive me for disagreeing insofar as we completely socialize the cost of education in this country. Nobody pays to attend a public school. That doesn't mean it's free. We share that cost.
Property taxpayers do.
Well, sure. You're reinforcing my point. And it hasn't worked out very well for us, you know, boxcar numbers of American children, which is, you know, when I started as a public school teacher, I was a adamant public school supporter, and I evolved into a choice advocate over the years because it wasn't working for the South Bronx students I was teaching. Doesn't mean that I want to abandon public education. Doesn't mean I want to abandon public health either. But it's not as binary as if it mattered, we'd socialize it.
I thought it was interesting what Bill was saying, how we really do have a lot of socialization.
Yeah, right.
And that's true. I mean, with 40% of your population on Medicaid and the Essential Plan in New York, and we have people still objecting. We don't want socialism, but we have it.
Yeah.
But we do. And we just don't like to admit it.
Let's go to a couple more letters. This one from Brian, listening to the roundtable. And I think we should keep in mind that healthcare providers have regional CEOs that each make over $10 million salaries in a lot of cases, followed by ridiculous bonuses, as if a person already making millions should get a bonus, all while they keep increasing premiums for the citizens they are supposed to be helping serve. The issue is always greed. Pay caps and profit ratios should be used to mar laws requiring companies to reinvest in the businesses to lower costs, improve employees' work safety, pay, and benefits. This should apply to the healthcare industry as well. That is all, in my humble opinion, says Brian. All right, we go to Jocelyn. It does not feel like an exceptional or rare situation when you are one of those people that will not be able to afford healthcare. When you operate a small business and have to provide your own health care, make just over the amount that makes you eligible for Medicaid, but not enough to make you able to afford outrageous health care costs, where does that leave you? Not very just in a system where you pay a ton of taxes as a self-employed individual and are going to be placed into a situation where you can't afford to have insurance.
I do think that the fact that so much healthcare is employer provided stifles innovation, because you have people who feel like they have to take a job, they have to stay at a job for that healthcare, and it prevents them from starting their own businesses, maybe from changing, you know, their employment to a different location, to a different employer. And it really does stifle things. You know, this is a sort of awkward situation that we have where healthcare is expected to be provided by the employer. And it may not make sense. I mean, I know, you know, Ulster County, I work for Ulster County, we're self-insured, and that has resulted in lower cost health insurance for our members. And I'm thanking, you know, thank goodness right now, myself personally, that I have employer provided health insurance. Many people don't.
I actually thought that when Obamacare passed, when the Affordable Care Act passed, it set up these insurance exchanges, which was to help people who didn't have employer sponsored insurance. They'd be able to purchase insurance as if they were in a group, and so they would get the lower prices that go with that. And I thought, ooh, that's like a first step towards decoupling insurance from employer, because employers. More and more people, the thing is that the Obamacare also had this thing where, as if employers didn't offer insurance, they paid a penalty.
Right.
And so you would need to modify Obamacare to facilitate people buying their own insurance, which I think is really, like, that would be a good thing to do. If we were all in those exchanges instead of getting insurance to the market, we would be exercising our consumer choice. We would be shopping for price and quality. We would be sending signals back to the insurers and the provider community. That would be a good thing, instead of having it filter through the employers.
And it would bring a bigger pool.
Yeah.
A bigger pool.
We would all be, everybody who wasn't in Medicaid and Medicare would be in the pool. And that would spread the risk. And that would be a good thing. A
couple more letters before we take a break and wrap up on this Friday morning. Deborah says, my husband is a retired SUNY professor. Our Empire Plan insurance just went up about $175 a month for family coverage. Family coverage for the two of us is more than three times the price of individual coverage. The premium is paid by the banked sick days he did not use over 25 years. My understanding is that it's a fixed amount of money from which we draw the monthly premium until it runs out. The premium increase deletes this amount more quickly, setting up a problem in our later years.
Joe, could I say something about the Essential Plan and how I don't want to just come off as somebody who just supports keeping what we have, because I think there are a lot of problems. I know somebody who's a small business owner who's on the Essential Plan. They're able to buy work boots on that plan. And they are able to take their kids to Legoland as a part of that plan. And I just do not think that should be, you should not be able to use any health insurance for entertainment purposes, even if it's involving your family, or buy garments or, you know. So I think that we do need to tighten these things, and we should be looking for waste, fraud and abuse in them.
So the listener who wrote in is a state retiree, right? And, and they're on the Empire Plan. That is the best insurance that exists on this planet today, right? Like the
doesn't get better than that for
well,
most
people.
Well,
it's very comprehensive insurance, but also the state is paying most of the cost. And then, as she explained, retirees who have unused vacation days can, like, they can bank that and then use it to pay to, like, it's just a very generous plan compared to what most people have.
I just want to go back to something. I'm not looking to be argumentative, but I my understanding on the thing about the health plans that give you different stuff is that you accumulate what they refer to as health points, and you do these things and you go through the hoops and you go in and I don't know, I've tried 87 times to figure this out. I've never gotten a dime from it. But it is interesting, but that's different though, isn't it? I mean, if they put you through this whole rigmarole and say, if you do this, if you do this, if you do this, if you go to the gym, if you get all your vaccines, if you do this, if you do that, if you eat a lot of kale.
That's using it as an incentive. That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to go do further research, and I apologize that I didn't do it before the show. But It was not incentive based. It was not like, oh, you got all these, you got your vaccines, you went for your your preventative, therefore you can buy a pair of boots. It was like, no, you can actually buy a pair of boots.
Yeah, because I know they like this time of year, there's like a get your points in because then we're going to give you your card and you get, you know, you get your gift card for whatever.
And I would support that because it's going to bring down prices because it's going to prevent, you know, major health issues.
So part of what's going on there is there are these laws requiring insurers to cover.
By the way, and everybody should go to Legoland. Go ahead.
There are these laws, the rule that's very popular, which says insurers have to cover pre-existing conditions. And so there's no underwriting. Insurers aren't allowed to, like, look at your risk profile and set your premium based on that. So they have an incentive to try and find the healthiest customers that they can possibly find. And one way they do that is by offering gym memberships because sick people don't go to the gym. And so if you offer, I mean, I'm generalizing and simplifying.
Of course, yes,
but,
of course.
But if you, these enhanced benefits are attractive to healthier customers. That's why, and so the people who are, you know, when they have a choice of Medicare Advantage is a common example of this, where you have a choice of Medicare Advantage plans, the sicker patients are going to be really focused on what drugs are covered and what providers are covered. The healthier patients are going to be like, oh, it's going to pay for my YMCA membership. I'll take that one.
Yeah.
So that's part of what's going on with those seemingly non-medical type benefits.
Even if you lower my premiums, I will not eat kale. Kale, yeah. No.
There is no level of incentive.
None.
Jeffrey says the rich do not pay their fair share. They use tax attorneys to pay very little of their share. Look at Trump for one example. Final letter on this topic. I've always liked the way the German healthcare system operates. Health insurance is mandatory, with the administration handled by nonprofit sickness funds. These funds are funded by employee contributions, employer contributions, and the government subsidizes those who require it.
So that's not that different from our system, with the exception that it's mandatory.
We'll take a break. We'll come back, finish up, wrap up the show for this Friday. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and our panel discussion. I just want to mention that coming up at 11 o'clock, we have a great program. It's called Hanukkah Lights, and it's NPR's Hanukkah Lights 2025. It is an annual favorite here at WAMC. It's an annual favorite throughout NPR stations and around the country. And it returns this year with a new story, a couple new stories, plus gems from the archive. The show has always been hosted by Murray Horowitz and Susan Stamberg. It will be hosted by Murray Horowitz this year with a special tribute to Susan Stamberg, who passed away just a couple of months ago. But coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, Hanukkah Lights 2025 will be broadcast, and just wanted to make you aware of that. All right. Final moments with our panel and with our listeners this morning, if they are so inclined to check in and bring letters to us. Let's talk about expanded access to marijuana, CBD, citing medical benefits, according to the Trump administration. They ordered federal agencies to quickly ease restrictions on marijuana and make CBD more available, the latest indicator of how the once taboo drugs have increasingly become part of America's mainstream. Trump framed the moves as efforts to improvise medical research and stressed that he was not decriminalizing marijuana on a federal level, as many states have for recreational or medical use. Federal officials also warned Thursday about the potential addictive risks and urged adolescents not to use cannabis. But the president's announcement delivered from the Oval Office represents a significant shift in how Republicans have approached the substances. Four decades after President Ronald Reagan declared a war on drugs, and many lawmakers pushed for harsh crackdowns on marijuana users.
I'm going to be that guy and super old-fashioned on this. You know, I understand the logic behind this. Marijuana legislation has moved faster than federal law, and presidents of both parties have been trying to square that circle for a while now. I'm just bothered by the normalization, folks. I just am. You know, we're living through a period where daily marijuana use is increasingly common, especially for young people. increasingly potent and increasingly disconnected from any consequence, any sense that there might be some trade-offs, especially for young people. We all know people, right, for whom this is a problem. So the normalization bugs me.
It's the first time that a Schedule III drug has not been FDA approved, and it really would be good to have a good FDA analysis as a part of this process. But I have to tell you, I was actually in a dispensary. My cousin owns a dispensary in Kingston, Catskill Mountain High. I went in to say hello to her when this Trump news broke, and she was cheering.
There you go.
It doesn't really affect these cannabis businesses here, but I thought it was interesting to learn that it's going to affect certainly medical cannabis businesses, because now they'll be able to take tax write-offs. Mm. And, you know, this whole industry has really been hampered by that tax situation, and I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, I know that you can't use a credit card in a dispensary. You have to pay cash or a debit card, but I hadn't really thought about what the tax implications are for those businesses, and this has become big business. I mean, the county gets a couple $100,000 a year now in revenues, which isn't a big part of our budget, but for the towns in Ulster County, it is growing to be 2-3% of their total budget. It's kind of interesting.
Man, I feel old. I mean, all the stuff that was taboo when I was a kid, gambling, marijuana, et cetera, now it's a revenue source.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's scary when you prioritize revenue over health.
That's
right. We've definitely seen that in gambling, for sure, in marijuana.
I'm basically a libertarian when it comes to marijuana, cannabis. But one thing that does kind of, I find interesting is the way... Like the first step in New York, as it was in other states, was that they legalized it for medical purposes.
Right.
But in the process, they kind of erased all of their prior understanding of like how drugs are supposed to be approved. You just mentioned it's like there's been no. The normal process for approving a drug is you have to have a thing that shows that it's effective and safe. That's done through clinical trials, scientific process. That hasn't really happened to the proper degree when it comes to cannabis. But it's like a benign fiction because it gave lawmakers an avenue to say, okay, we're going to lighten up on marijuana. We're going to stop treating it as if it's heroin. We're going to stop throwing people in prison for long terms because of their use of marijuana, and we're doing it for medical reasons, which inevitably led to legalizing it for recreational purposes.
Right.
So it is. It's like everybody sort of pretends like, oh, it's for medical purposes, when really it's just they don't want to demonize it. They don't want to overcriminalize.
Yeah.
So I had direct experience.
Dispensary.
I had direct experience with medical marijuana. My mother has Alzheimer's, and we got her a medical marijuana card, and she took cannabis in chocolate because trying to get somebody who has Alzheimer's to take another pill is just impossible. And it was the difference between I want to die and look at those puppies. I mean, it was shocking.
Okay.
Like, it really had a calming, incredible effect. And when she first went into the memory care unit she's in now, she was one of two patients there receiving cannabis. Now there's many more, and it's had a reduction in the overall use of other drugs. So it's a shame that we're not really doing the drug research we need, because there really are good uses. And I look forward to seeing like now the Schedule III science behind some of this.
Yeah.
And I think it will also point out some of the risks, and it will help us be more careful in how we deploy it.
No, that's a really compelling point, and thank you. And I'm sorry your mom's going through that, but what a great point, Bill, that it starts out as medical use, and then that's the normalization that
I remember when New York legalized it. I think it was Andrew Cuomo was governor. He's like, we're going to allow pills and tinctures, but we're not going to allow smoking. And I was like, what's your scientific basis for that? But it clearly does help some people.
Of course, yeah.
And I don't dispute that or even doubt it, but it's... We don't know exactly when it helps and who it helps, and there are other people who it does harm, and we should study that.
My thanks to March Gallagher, Bill Hammond, and Robert Pendicio for being with us. You all are wonderful. I appreciate you spending your time. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us on these important issues. Have a beautiful holiday.
You as well,
Joe.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Same to you, Joe.
Be well. We'll be back and continue with the roundtable and present NPR's Hanukkah Lights 2025 right after this.